bit of fun this morning. Chris, could you turn this down just a little bit? Oh, no, not that. They teach you in public speaking that the way you're supposed to start a speech is with a joke, because that loosens everybody up. And sometimes I do that and sometimes I don't. I'm going to tell you some funny stuff this morning, but it's going to lead into a more serious topic. One of my favorite characters is a guy named Spooner. Spooner was an Anglican priest during the late 1800s and early 1900s. And although he lives on in the expression Spoonerism, which means when you mix words or letters up in expression, he was actually a pretty bright guy. In fact, he's described as somebody who was so smart that his brain got way ahead of his tongue, and his tongue would mix things up as it tried to catch up with his brain. And I'll give you a couple of examples, and then I'll give you some Spoonerisms. He was an albino. He was small, had a pink face, poor eyesight, a very large head, and his reputation was that he was genial, kindly, and hospitable. And he was the pastor and a teacher of Anglican studies and a scholar at Oxford University, and preached in the chapel there regularly. He once invited a faculty member to tea, and he said, "We want you to come in order to welcome the new archaeology fellow." In other words, the new archaeology professor. "But sir," the man replied, "I am our new archaeology fellow." "Never mind," Spooner said, "come all the same." One of the things that he used to do regularly was mix words up or parts of words in sentences, and I'll give you just two or three examples. And if you just go on the internet and put in the word Spoonerism, you'll find a ton of these, some of them which are original with him and some which have been made up based on how he did it. I'm going to give you four real ones from Spooner. Lighting a fire became fighting a liar. Our loving shepherd became our shoving leopard. Is the dean busy? Became, is the bean dizzy? And then this one, our dear old queen became our queer old dean. And then finally, my favorite from Spooner is he preached, some of you have heard this from me before, he preached an entire sermon. At the end of the sermon, sat down, reflected for a moment, then got back up to the pulpit and said, "In the sermon I just preached, everywhere that I said Aristotle, I meant Paul." So, I wanted to have a little fun with words, because words are really important in our lives, both in regular conversation and understanding the Word made flesh, in the reading that we heard from John today, even in the reading we heard from the beginning of chapter 62 in Isaiah, where God says, "I'll change your name." There's something important about words, and particularly about names, and it's something that we need to be cognizant of and grapple with a little bit. And there's been a lot done in this area in philosophy, a lot of it in what's now called semantics. And S.I. Hayakawa, who was a teacher at San Francisco State and the sleeping senator, when he was senator from California for a while, he was renowned for sleeping through Senate debates in Washington, for which I hold him in high esteem. Anyway, Hayakawa is another great writer on semantics and the importance of words. If you haven't read him, just go enjoy him. He's really great. My favorite, however, is a German philosopher, Austrian actually, I think, Ludwig Wittgenstein. Who's heard of Wittgenstein? See, he's not well known. A handful of folks have heard of Wittgenstein. And he was not a particularly likable fellow, in that he was relatively depressed most of the time, lived sort of a tortured personal existence. But he was one of these people who so expertly pokes holes in others' bubbles, bursts their bubbles when they're off on a path that really doesn't make any sense. And one of the ways that he did that for philosophy was all philosophers had basically agreed at that point, or at least all of the leading ones, that the reason things had names was because they had a certain kind of identity, an inner essence, and the name for them really was a description of that inner essence. And this goes back to Plato in his idea of pure forms, and I won't go into all of that. But the idea in philosophy was there's an inner essence. And so if you had something like this chair, the philosophers would put a label on it, which was chair, and they'd say this label, the sound of this word in and of itself is really sort of irrelevant. It could be anything. It could be maca instead of chair. But when it's attached to something that looks like this, what it's really describing is the inner essence of chairness. Get the idea? Chairness. So that things which are used as chairs are chairs because sort of in the fundamental hidden sense of things, what in Aristotle and in Thomas Aquinas is called their substance, there's something called chairness. Their accident, substance and accident, the accident is what we see, sort of the outward manifestation of this inward thing of chairness. And it's that chairness that allows it to be used for the purpose for which it was intended. It inheres or it contains that chairness. Then you come along with something that looks like this. Now, this is a little table. Now, most anybody in this room wouldn't have any trouble distinguishing which was the table and which was the chair, right? Yet they both have four legs. They both have a horizontal surface that things can be placed on. This one has a back, but not all chairs have backs. So I could say, well, this is actually a chair. It just doesn't have a back on it, and I wanted to sit on it. Well, now it's a chair. A minute ago, it was a table, but I'm sitting on it, and clearly I'm using it as a chair, so it must inhere some chairness as well as its tableness. And, of course, I could take this poinsettia, and I could put it over here on this thing with a back, and now it's a table. So it must contain some of this essence, this substance of tableness as well. Well, Wittgenstein said, you guys are nuts. This is stupid. What it is that you're saying. There's no such thing as chairness or tableness that's somehow inherent to this thing. What if I took one of the legs off of it? Would it still be a chair? Would the chairness still be there? How about if I took two legs off? Three legs off? Four legs off? Does the chairness stay there until I remove the fourth leg and then the chairness disappears somewhere? So Wittgenstein had a great old time really tearing apart all of that philosophical baloney. He did a really good job at it, and I just love the way he took apart that bad thinking, that incompetent philosophy. And he basically said, look, we attach labels to things for convenience, and it's a method of communicating with each other. We have some agreed upon understanding about what we mean by chair, and that allows us to talk. But that doesn't mean that there's any sort of inner property of the thing we're talking about, of chairness. It's just a quality of the language that allows us to chat. So the extreme of what Wittgenstein describes, and I actually like Wittgenstein, I think he's really good, but some people could take it further, and the extreme end of that idea would be words have no real meaning or power in and of themselves. They're just mere labels. Could be randomly chosen. What we call a chair, as I said, we could have called it maca. And as long as we all agreed that it's maca, then that's the label that we use for that. But neither chair nor maca has any inherent power. That's one end of the idea about language on a spectrum here. The other end is common to folk religion, but there's also some of it in Scripture, and that is the idea that there is in a word power. In fact, many folk religions believe that if I know your secret name, I have power over you. If I know the secret name of a tree, I have spiritual power over the tree. If I know the secret name of a mouse or a cat or whatever, I have power over it. Many of the occult practices of some of the religions like voodoo and so on are based on that idea. But if you know the secret name of something, you can control it even from a distance. That's sort of the other extreme here of this idea about words and power. I think both of those are wrong, by the way. But I also believe that there is something, and Scripture talks about it, which is genuine about naming and words, and that has an intimate and almost inextricable connection to power. A simple example of that, rather pedestrian, would be when a policeman says, "What's your name?" And you want to say, "Tim Smith," when it's not. Because, you know, if he knows your name, he can find you. And so it's one of the reasons why crooks have aliases. It's not just because they like a bunch of different names. It's because if they've committed a crime under one alias, they're not likely to be found associated with it if they're arrested under another alias. So in a sense there, the name has power because it identifies somebody. And that identification allows them to be found again. So that's one simple sense in which a name has power. The Greeks believed that in the naming, in the word, there was fundamental creative power. And in fact, what you heard read this morning from the beginning of the book of John, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. All things were created through Him. Not one thing was created that He did not create." The Word. That word in Greek is logos. If you read that, John, in Greek, "In the beginning was the Word," that word in Greek is logos. Well, this is a common term in Greek philosophy because the Greeks believed that there was, not all Greeks, but many of the schools of Greek philosophy believed that there was a creator distant, unapproachable, unknowable. And there was the creation, which is us and the planet that we live on and everything else. And in between the two was an intermediary by which the Creator made the creation. And that intermediary was called Logos. Interesting? That intermediary was called the Word. So when John wrote the Gospel of John and said, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God," he was speaking in Greek terminology, which Greeks understood, except that he turned the universe upside down. Because the Greeks imagined this logos, the means of creation, to be not a person, but a mechanism. Not a person, but a mechanism, a machine, if you would. A vast cosmic machine which turned the creative intent of the Creator into the creation. And John says, this is not a machine, it is a person. And that person was with God, that is, the Creator, from the beginning. And in fact, that intermediary, if you would, isn't just an intermediary machine, that intermediary is God. And that intermediary became human and lived among us. This is like tossing a little philosophical chaos bomb into the middle of Greek philosophy. It just upsets everything. It's not as they imagined. It's not this mechanism by which things are created. It's a creator, a person doing it who actually comes and lives among us in order to restore the order lost by our waywardness. So in Scripture, and not just in John, but throughout all of the Old and the New Testament, there's an intimate connection in understanding between the Word, the naming, if you would, and the creation. They're considered almost identical. God spoke, and the universe came into existence. It was the speaking that called it into existence. He speaks and calls us to return. Power in that word. And so we need to realize, not only, I believe, is this true, but it is also true of us in our individual lives, because we are made in the image of God. And when we speak words and names, we create. Loser. Liar. Thief. Some other words which I won't use out loud, that many of us have been named by in the course of growing up. Today, the big thing now is this. You hold your hand up so it looks like an L, and you put it above somebody when they're not looking. What you're saying is, loser, right? There's creative power in that. When I say to a child particularly, but this is true with adults too, you're a loser. Just get out of here. Don't come back. You're a loser. Not only is that hurtful when I say that, but there is power in what I've said. Because I have said to that person, you're not a person who maybe messed up right now. You are a person who by nature, by identity, by person, who you are, is loser or thief or liar. So I have creative power over the people around me by the language that I use when I engage them. That creative power is the same kind of creative power that God has, that Jesus has, as the universe is spoken into existence. And that description isn't, or that word, that creative naming, that creative act in naming, isn't just description. I could say, well, she really is a loser. That's why I use the word. I mean, it really is a dummy. Really is utterly uncoordinated. What a spaz. What a sissy. Some other words I won't use. But you know, my point here is that the labeling has power over the person being labeled. It changes things. It changes reality. It isn't a mere label. It isn't just a tag. It has creative power for destruction or for good. I can either use that creative power that I have in my language as a slur and a condemnation, and like it or not, it creates that in the person I say it to. I might say sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt me. That's not true. Names do hurt. And they have the power to have long-term consequence in people's lives. I know a fellow who grew up with a great interest in the arts and in music, was engaged, went off to college, came back from college, and his fiancée said, well, you've been away. I've spent a fair amount of time with other men who were interested in the arts and in music, and they were all gay. And I'm not going to marry you because I've concluded from that, because you're interested in music and the arts, you're gay. Broke off the engagement. This man had never considered that that was what he was, or probably even that that was a category of being, until this woman that he loved and was engaged to said those words to him. He never had a relationship with a woman since. And I don't believe she was right, by the way. I don't believe she'd made some miraculous discovery and privileged him with her insight. I think she created what she spoke. In fact, I think our culture is doing that in many ways with those words right now. They're creating what they speak. This has nothing to do with whether we care about people or love them, but it has a lot to do with how we label them and what effect that naming, that labeling, has on their lives. It has creative power. Jesus told us that we were to love God and to love our neighbors as ourselves. You've heard me say this many times. The word that Jesus used for that, love, is agape in Greek. It doesn't mean have warm, fuzzy feelings toward. It means take an action that will bless this person. That's what the word means. You don't even have to like them. That's not what Jesus said, like people. He said, love them. Take an action that will bless them, that will help assure their success, for that matter, that will help redeem them, that will help bring them into more intimate relationship with their Creator. Bless them in that way. That's the word Jesus used. That's what it means. It means take an action. Take an action for the blessing, for the redemption, for the care of other people. Take an action. And this is how I conclude today. The words we speak are a part of the action that we take, because it has creative power. I know so many people who have been labeled by nickname or by accusation or by slur, who are trapped, damaged by that act done before. And as believers in Jesus Christ, when He says, you love your neighbors as you love yourself, one of the things that that includes is renaming them. Not loser, but giver. Not liar, but one who desires the truth and maybe struggles with it sometimes. If I keep saying liar, 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 I reinforce what that person already believes. If I say, let's find the truth together, then we go on a quest together to find truth. And that person is built up by my creative naming. And so I can choose that my words will bring slur and condemnation to others, which is a destructive but profound act, a true act of creation, but it creates destruction in a person's soul. Or I can choose to do what Jesus does, and that is to name honor, to name hope, to redefine by the words that I use, by the names that I give to those who are around me, so that they might be given hope, be set free from those evil nicknames, from those horrendous slurs which they suffered. It doesn't mean there won't be struggle in their life or mine. There will be. It doesn't mean there won't be failure in their life or mine. There will be. But I have the creative power of naming, part of the gift of God to me, because I was made in His image, to speak words of comfort and honor and hope which break bars of prisons and set prisoners free. When God says in Scripture and we sing, I will change your name, this is not mere talk. It is a fundamental creative act. And either we participate with God in the creative act of building and raising up and giving hope and restoration, or we participate with the other side in destroying and condemning and tearing down. Which one does Jesus want us to choose?